Clinton and Trump may not be talking about their education policies. Green Party candidate Jill Stein is. Our activist of the week just wants kids to be kids. We will update you on what's trending in education news, have a moment of zen, and wait until you hear what Matt Damon's mom has to say. Let's bust some pencils.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slecker and Dr. Jed Hopkins. It's time to take a look at the top trending news stories in education.
Donald Trump on education, what do we know? We know he hates the Common Core. We know he hates the Department of Education. We know he... Wait, something seems to be consistent in everything we talk about with Donald, and that's the word hate. What is it with hate in Donald? Well, according to one teacher that was in the Huffington Post, we need to look really deeply at the fact that maybe the issue with Donald Trump isn't that his education policies are bad. It's the fact that his behavior is bad. And when we look at schooling, his behavior is actually middle school bullying. Middle school bullying that we are trying to actually eradicate with kids because we know it's bad behavior. Instead, we are about to have a presumptive nominee who truly is a bully. Donald Trump, education bully.
This is Busted Pencils Radio. Fully leaded education talk.
Hey, I wonder what Matt Damon's mom thinks about Donald Trump.
Wait, what? You want to know what my mom would say? All right, well, just ask her.
Well, you know, it's pretty hard to actually know what Donald Trump thinks about education because he hasn't said much. And, of course, no candidate has said much, which is education is the topic they all love to just omit. But we do know that he likes to brand his name, right? Because there's, like, Trump Wine and Trump Casinos. And there is Trump University. So I think it's probably, you know, if he gained power, we'd probably have Trump high schools, Trump middle schools, and Trump preschools and elementary schools. And I think, actually, kids would probably love going to a Trump preschool because, you know, like they could do some really cool curriculum things. Like they could have some blonde comb over wigs in the dramatic play area, for example, and people could act out roles. Like they could act out their education leader, Trump, you know.
Right.
And then they could really, you know, like bully each other and call each other pussies and rapists and things. And the teacher wouldn't be able to do much because they're just role playing their leader.
They could be fired.
Oh yeah, just fire them. Just get rid of them or sit down and be quiet. Well, the teacher could treat them the same way that they would be acting, and then the whole thing would go south, of course. But I just think that a lot of what Trump says is actually very understandable to preschoolers, and that they would find him a really interesting leader because he'd probably make more sense to them than most adults. But, you know, in terms of ed policy, I think I know he doesn't like the Common Core, although he doesn't explain why, because, you know, he doesn't explain why about much. I think that probably, I would guess, has to do more with, like, an overreach of the federal role or something. But he's a businessman, so I am sure that his education policies would be right in line and then some with what we've already seen. He would want to promote and expand this whole model of choice, competition, rewards and punishments that's really ruined and tyrannized our schools. I'm sure that he would take that same approach to it.
This is Matt Damon on Busted Pencils Radio. Please stop bothering me and just ask my mom already.
The two presidential candidates doing the most talking don't seem to have anything to say one way or the other about education. Green Party candidate Jill Stein has powerful ideas for public education in America. I spoke with her on the topic at the United Opt-Out Conference, where she was a keynote speaker. Here is our conversation. Welcome, Green presidential 2016 candidate, Dr. Jill Stein.
It's awesome to be here, Tim. It's great to be a part of Busted Pencils, and how do we put those pencils back together again?
Talking to you is actually is a treat. You're a medical doctor, and the opt-out movement talks about the damaging effects of testing, stress, and things. Could you validate that, or is that just a bunch of weird parents that are afraid to allow their kids to get exposed to certain things? Because that's what we hear.
Yeah. You know, I reject this idea that we have to tune out our kids, you know, that their feelings and their stress levels doesn't matter, you know, that we need to just toughen them up and, you know, put them through a boot camp here. You know, let's put them through, you know, like a devastating kind of education and get them ready for that tough world out there. You know, we need to change that world out there, and we need to start by changing it here in our schools. And, you know, as a medical doctor, as a mother, as someone who has taught, you know, not as a trained teacher, and I respect the training that goes into it, but way back when I used to teach guitar to kids, and I learned about when kids learn and when they don't learn, you know, and then I went on to teach much older kids that had graduated medical school about being a doctor. And, you know, you sort of pick up that there are things that work and things that don't work, and stressing especially young kids out is not helpful. It's not helpful to learning. It's not helpful to their social development, to their cognitive development. You know, you can go into the weeds here about how the brain works and what stress does, and that stress promotes a, you know, not good metabolism. And we know that stress is harmful, for example, to the cardiovascular system or to neurodevelopment and to learning. This is not rocket science. And, you know, the science actually supports that what is hurtful to our kids, what is upsetting to them, is not going to help them learn. If the cause here is to promote learning, then we need to do it in an unstressful way. If you look at how the wealthy, you know, the super rich, educate their kids, you know, are they putting them through a boot camp and making them feel insecure and subjecting them to weeks of sitting at a desk and taking pen and pencil tests, and then subjecting them to an entire curriculum that's focused on this very narrow, boring, rote learning kind of education? That's how you turn people off. Those who have actual resources and control over their private schools, they never do this. You know, the countries that actually invest in their school systems, they never do this. And when they try to persuade you to toughen up, you know, just be tough with your kids. You know, this is boot camp. Let's treat our schools like the military. Let's militarize our families, for that matter. That's what they're telling you to do. That needs to be rejected. You know, that is absolute, you know, propaganda from the predator. And just say no to that, you know, reject that. It's time to stand up for who we are as a society and the world we want to create for our kids, starting in our families and in our schools.
You're the Green Party presidential candidate, and what you just said comes at me, you know, first of all, as one of the founders of United Opt Out, the creator of this Busted Pencils show, an activist now. Everything you said, I'm looking for a candidate at the state level, representative even, to say, why is it so hard for politicians to say what you just said, which was, we should do what's best for kids, those who among us have the means to do, we should do that for all kids. And actually, that's John Dewey made that quote a long time ago. And I'm paraphrasing it, you know, what the best, the most wealthy, the most powerful provide for their children should be the standard for all kids. Why is that so hard for politicians to say?
Because our political system is the, you know, I don't dare use that language here on air, but it has become sort of a set of walking zombies, you know, who are basically in the pocket of those who got money, you know, and those who got money includes, you know, the likes of the hedge funds investors that are making out like bandits here on the privatization of our schools, on the charter industry, on the testing industry. You know, we have a political system, the best that money could buy, and that's who it serves. Money is pouring in from, you know, the likes of Bill Gates and the whole education industrial complex that's grown up. Not, you know, he didn't start it, but he's certainly a part of it. You know, we've got this kind of commodification of education. We are turning education into a business model, or sometimes it's a behavioral rat model. And this idea that, you know, shock students, you know, into what you don't want them to do or learn, and that's going to help. You know, it's like, this is what education is about. People study education. There is a science of education. There's a science of pedagogy. You know, there's actually a whole rich history here of how do we educate kids? How do we get some, you know, it's not like you bring in a basketball player like Arnie Duncan, you know, and you make him head of your, you make him Secretary of Education. What does this guy know about it? You know, absolutely nothing. They apply the business model. You know, you've got Bill Gates applying the business model. Education needs a democracy model. This is about a foundation of education. It's about the development of our younger generation. It's about stimulating their growth and their thinking. This is not, you know, the rat model does not apply here. Let's just get rid of that.
Okay, so what you've just said, if that's true, isn't that the other reason why we don't want to provide an education for the majority of kids, a real education? Because the solution is providing an inadequate education. Doesn't that just keep the corporate oligarchy meritocracy in place?
It sure does. And, you know, I don't think you need to invoke a conspiracy theory. This is what happens when the fox is put in charge of guarding the chicken coop. The fox will act in the fox's interest. And that's what you have happening in education, in healthcare, in our, you know, our defense, so-called defense industry, which is an offense industry, you know, housing, across the board. It's all become another way to profiteer, another way to put profit ahead of people. You know, you can argue whether they are intending to harm people. I think you don't even need to waste time debating that, because clearly their intention is to benefit their own bottom line. There's a famous saying from the author of The Jungle, whose name I'm not recalling at the moment, who was a candidate for governor in New York. This was back in the early 1900s, I think. And what he said was, it's hard to convince a man of something when his income depends on not knowing it. And so we've got, you know, to quote another famous person, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court back in the early 1900s, who said, we have a choice between a democracy or vast concentrations of wealth. We have vast concentrations of wealth, and that is just not compatible with a democracy. So you have special interests who basically buy their way in to control the rules of the road.
Controlling education is the first place we've seen throughout history is when you want an oligarchic power that wants to not give of itself, diminish education.
Absolutely. Education is a very dangerous thing. A creative mind is very powerful, and an empowered spirit is a big threat to corporate control. And this is what prevails in our school system now and is getting worse. And it's there at every level, whether you're talking about our public schools, which have been commodified, forced into this high-stakes testing, you know, model, and you know, and you have it at the higher education level as well, where you have an entire generation of students which were lured into this paralyzing student debt. And, you know, I feel like I'm a political therapist. You know, I'm a medical doctor that sort of turned from clinical medicine to political medicine because it's the mother of all illnesses. And what I do in this field of political medicine is administer therapy and help people break up with an abusive relationship. Right. You know, an abusive relationship with a political culture that is in bed with big corporations and is there to serve them, and which has changed the rules of the road. So you see things like the Democrats, the supposed progressive Democrats, who all voted against the Lee Amendment to the Every Child Achieved Act, which would have enabled students to opt out of this very harmful and destructive form of testing.
But that's it, though. If they would have allowed us to opt out of this very harmful form of testing, there's no power in that movement then.
Exactly. And the analog to that is that's why they won't allow us a democratic voting system. Because if they did, if they gave us a system of voting where we really have free choice and we know who our choices are, they would lose control. So what do? They keep political opposition off the ballot, out of the media, and out of the debates. Because when we get into the debates, we win those debates because we have the liberty to actually speak of, by, and for the people. We are not on the corporate payroll. We don't take corporate money, so we can actually speak to those things that people need, like good quality public schools that are fully funded, that teach to the student for lifetime learning, jobs as a right, at living wages. a system that puts people, planet, and peace over profit. Not only does it like have the right solutions, but it actually has the power that we need. And if I can just lay one more factoid on you, it's that there are 43 million young people who are locked into student debt right now. And if word gets out,
there's also middle-aged 49-year-old professors who are locked into student debt right now too, just to let you know.
Right.
Not that I would know one.
So I should qualify that to say young people and not quite so young people who are locked into that debt without a way to get out of it. So if you let your friends know who are in debt that they can come out and cancel that debt by voting green, 43 million votes for the only candidate who will cancel student debt. We did it for the bankers. It's about time we did it for the students. You know, the crooks who got the economy into this mess, we saw fit to bail them out. How about we bail out the victims of that for far less and in a bailout that would be an incredible stimulus to the economy as well. 43 million people who hear that they can actually accomplish this because it is within presidential power to basically get this done. You don't need an act of Congress to create this bailout, which is basically a quantitative easing that the Fed can do, and the president appoints the Fed. So not such a hard thing. It can actually be accomplished. If word gets out to young people that ending debt is as simple as checking the green box on November 8th, that could actually happen. That could actually happen, and there's no more self-mobilizing a constituency that young people than young people in debt. So it's really important for us to recognize that we're dealing with a very corrupt, predatory political system, which is destroying our schools, our jobs, our health, our climate, our environment, our security, international security as well. We can fix that, and we actually have the numbers that can fix that. We have the numbers that can turn this around the minute we stand up with the courage of our convictions. So, you know, I think the bottom line here is rejecting the lesser evil and its intimidation that tells you resistance is futile. They say that because they're quaking in their boots, because they know we got the numbers and they know we've got the solutions. It's all about getting the word out. We can reject the lesser evil, stand up and fight for the greater good, and that is within our reach.
Dr. Jill Stein, as we say on the show, you are truly busting pencils. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It's been such an honor, Tim, to be here today and to be at this wonderful conference of United Opt Out. And I say, you go, you team. We are amazing. Together, we are absolutely unstoppable. Thank you for leading the way.
This is Busted Pencils Radio. Fully leaded education talk.
Her experience as a second grade teacher has led her to become an education activist. For Emily Kaplan, kids really do come first. Emily, you taught at and left a no-excuses school in Boston. Proponents of these types of school would argue that this is the best approach for low-achieving children of color and poverty. How could you leave?
Certainly a lot of people say that. I think one of the more dangerous arguments that people make is that there are some unfortunate aspects of this type of teaching, but ultimately it's necessary to, quote, close the achievement gap. And I think inherent in that kind of statement is a lot of racism and a lot of assumptions that Black and brown children of color, especially those living in poverty, aren't entitled to the types of privileges that we don't really think of as privileges, like recess and time for exploration and kindness that children in mostly white, upper middle class and wealthy suburban schools enjoy. So I think many people describe it as it's what they need. I think others more dangerously describe it as it's the best of what's available.
Yeah, it also seems to suggest that they have a lot of faith in achievement, this idea of
exactly.
Achievement, right? As though achievement was like something separate from all those other things you mentioned, like recess and the freedom to recreate, let's say.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. And that achievement can be measured exclusively by test scores, which I think is a very erroneous assumption.
Right. Well, it's an erroneous assumption. In fact, you go on to point out in the curmudgeonication piece, well, actually in both the Edushyster piece and the curmudgeonication piece, the fact that there is the predictability of high achievement from these no excuses schools actually doesn't seem to translate into future success, particularly when the kids get into high school or middle school and high school.
That's absolutely true. In my experience, I think not only are high test scores, especially in the early grades, not predictive of future success, but in the ways that I think matter. But I think that there's also a negative correlation there. I think that the methods that these schools use to, quote, achieve in these ways, especially for very young children, actually inhibits their ability to develop the skills that they will need to be independent thinkers, kids who advocate for themselves, kids who think outside the box. If you're only drilled on how to achieve in a very narrow sense, then it actually limits you in the ways that matter down the road.
Well, talking about recess, I like this little part you said in there as the students, and this is, quote, some of the things the students have to say every morning, 200 of them. You can imagine these kindergartners and first graders and second graders. Today is a step on my path towards success, they must say, yeah. And you point out that the kid next to you said his path to recess. And
right.
That might be a better and more appropriate response for a small child to be saying.
Absolutely.
That they should be on the path to recess. Jed?
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, I can't agree more, you know. Yeah, it's I was going to ask you, Emily, what it feels like being an educator activist. And I put the two words together deliberately there. I mean, has the articulation of these awful things that are going on, has that enhanced your identity as being an educator?
I hope so.
Yeah.
That's a great question. The fact is, I don't really know yet. You know, I'm still a relatively new teacher, and I'm certainly very new with writing about my experiences. So, you know, I hope so. I hope that I'm able to see the bigger picture through writing and through dialoguing with people who have read my writing. And also, I think more importantly, me reading a lot of what's been written by other people who know a lot more than I do. That opened the door for me to even know that there was a whole world out there mm-hmm. of people who think really, really intelligently and critically about these phenomena. Yeah, so I want to be part of that conversation. And I hope that my experiences teaching in a lot of very different settings will, in some very small way, you know, contribute to the very important dialogue that's going on right now about urban education.
So the facts are, right now, then, you are currently a second grade teacher at what we would say is a regular public school?
At a suburban public school.
Suburban public school. And it was last year. And was last year your first year as a teacher in the second grade in a no excuses school?
Yes.
So you went from no excuses second grade 1 year to second grade in a suburban regular school this year. You've now moved into this activist in your writing. You've been featured in Curmudgeocation. You've been featured in EduScheister. I like the fact, too, that you mentioned that you've also been featured in an indirect way by somebody writing about you in Huffington Post, an entire blog about why you're wrong. That's the best applause any not just emerging, but any activist and writer, blogger can
shows
get.
You touching nerves.
Yeah. So the future, from what I understand, Emily, from good friend of ours, Matt Damon's mom, is that you're going to be doing some guest blogging for Defending the Early Years, and that you're going to be doing some of your own. And as a way to say thank you, I also want to just tell you that Jed and I at Busted Pencils, if there's ever a piece that you think, you know, hey, it might fit good with what they are doing, we would love to feature any type of guest post from Emily Kaplan, the new emerging activist teacher of the week.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much. I love the work that you do, so that would be a huge honor. Thank you.
Jed, and what do we tell her?
Keep busting those pencils, Emily.
Thank you.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk.
Time now for our weekly nod to legendary activist Howard Zinn with a moment of Zinn.
When the Democrats are attacked for inciting class warfare, they shrink back. They don't say what obviously should be said. Yes, there is class warfare. There has always been class warfare in this country. The reason the Democrats shrink back is because the Democrats and the Republicans are on the same side of class warfare. They have slightly different takes. The Democrats are part of the upper class that is more willing to make concessions to the lower class in order to maintain their power. A quote from Howard Zinn, January 10th, 2001.
Want more Busted Pencils? Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Also, log on to BustedPencils.com to keep up with trending news, hear parts of the show, and nominate an activist of the week. For Jed Hopkins, I'm Tim Slecker, and thanks for busting pencils.